everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our topic today, the new civil war emerging in Ethiopia and the U.S. threats against a sovereign nation. My guest from San Francisco Bay Area is Ann Garrison. Ann is an independent journalist based in the area and a contributing editor for the Black Agenda Report. Much of her reporting focuses upon the internal conflicts and geopolitical events in Africa. In recent years, she's focused her attention on the civil war in Ethiopia and its change of government. In 2014, she received the Women's International Network for Democracy and Peace Prize for her reporting about the conflicts in the African Great Lakes region, and also contributes to the San Francisco Bay View, Black Star News, Counterpunch, Global Research, and African-related publications. She also produces a radio broadcast aired on KPFA and WBAI. Nice to have you with us today, Ann.
Thank you for having me.
And there's been a lot of misunderstanding and controversy over the civil wars and past political events in Ethiopia, as well as the United States' involvement. This has been a conflict you've been covering as a journalist for quite some time. The U.S. has been knees deep in other internal civil war conflicts over many decades now: Rwanda, Yemen, Indonesia, and look at what we've done in Syria and the government change in at least 85 countries since the end of World War II that we actually have documentation of. And millions of people have been displaced, many have been killed, and almost in every instance, the United States, looking back with true objectivity, has been on the wrong side of that conflict. And the media is no help on this, because if you look at most of the mainstream media, they support whatever our foreign policies are, and the major advocates going on talk shows as so-called experts all support this. They did this with weapons of mass destruction, with Judith Miller's New York Times piece, which was all false. Look at the consequences. Yet no one lost their job. No one had their reputation tarnished. But we spent trillions of dollars on these conflicts. Afghanistan is just the latest example of the conditions that we left the country in, its people, and still no resolution. So that's a little bit of the background. However, Ethiopia rarely ever appears in the news. There's been almost a blackout during the years that the U.S.-backed minority Tigray People's Liberation Front government ruled over a region of brutality against Ethiopians, which lasted from 1991 to 2018. And now that the group, and I mentioned that to the UN Secretary General Tedros, was the TPLF's health ministry, and he's now heads the World Health Organization. And anyhow, this past summer, the Nobel Prize in Peace, the laureate winner, Abiy, has been elected prime minister. The Biden administration is threatening sanctions. So since listeners are not familiar with this struggle and the region of terror, please take your time and provide a historical background and give examples of this terror campaign of brutality and the long-term cost to the Ethiopian people during the rule of these terrorists. What are the past atrocities, and what is the proof that the individuals who were ousted from power were responsible? Since when I read all of the major media and listened to some programs, including some popular programs on WBAI and other Pacifica stations, they're against this person. They're against the new democratically elected regime. They're for the old group, and they have all of their supporters and apologists coming forward to condemn you or anyone else that suggests that the narrative should be changed. Take your time. The forum is yours.
Okay. The TPLF ruled Ethiopia with an iron fist from 1991 to 2018. In 2018, popular uprisings forced the TPLF from power, and Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed became president. He won the Nobel Prize for almost immediately negotiating peace with Eritrea, which Ethiopia had been at war with. Now, it's become very clear since then that the Ethiopian war with Eritrea was actually the TPLF's war. The TPLF, if I haven't said this, is the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. They claim to represent the 6% of the population that lives in Tigray and speaks Tigrinya in the north of Ethiopia. And if you've been reading what the newspapers are saying and what Jake Tapper is reporting on CNN, then you've been hearing that the Ethiopian government is committing in Tigray. I should add that, unfortunately, this is what you will have been hearing on Democracy Now! As well. That's been the main storyline, that the Ethiopian government is committing genocide in Tigray. And the war began when the TPLF attacked a federal army base in Tigray last November 3rd and 4th in the middle of the night, killed a lot of soldiers in their beds. And the Ethiopian government, of course, responded. I mean, what nation would not to an attack on its federal army base, whether it was external or internal? But very quickly, the narrative turned to blame the Ethiopian government for the war. Over and over, it would be stated that the war began when Ethiopia attacked Tigray, or perhaps more commonly, it was the war began when Ethiopia responded to an alleged attack on its federal army base. This wasn't alleged. It happened at the time Tibor Nagy, this was before Biden was inaugurated. Tibor Nagy was the Undersecretary for African Affairs, or he might have been the Deputy Undersecretary, but anyway, he was in that assignment, and he was outraged. He was outraged that the TPLF had attacked this federal army base, and he has repeated that outrage since. He was also outraged when the TPLF attacked neighboring Eritrea, which is now a firm Ethiopian ally. As I said, the Ethiopian war with Eritrea was really the TPLF's war. They shot some rockets into Eritrea, close to Asmara, which is the capital of Eritrea. And the Eritrean army responded. There's been a lot of controversy about their presence and whether they are still present, the Eritrean troops. My guess based on everything I know is that they no longer are, but the media kept repeating that they are long after they left. Tell me something else you want to know. Here, one of the main things I was going to say today is that the UN human rights agencies have been very involved in a massive disinformation campaign about this. And a story broke this week in which several women who work for UN agencies, including one that deals with reproductive, women's and reproductive health, talked to a journalist, Jeff Pierce, who went to Ethiopia. They talked to him about how they had been pressured to report extreme cases of sexual and gender-based violence. This is one of the accusations, as it was in Libya, as it usually is, that the army that the U.S. doesn't like is guilty of rape. Now, of course, rape is a part of war. And one of the people I admire most in the world is Dennis McQuaid, Dr. Dennis McQuaid, who founded a hospital, Pansy Hospital, to treat women victims of sexual violence in Eastern Congo. But when the press keeps repeating that this one army is guilty of mass sexual violence, implying that the army the U.S. supports, the TPLF, has the CARE gene and would never do anything like that, you know you're getting the wrong story. These women who spoke to Jeff Pierce in Ethiopia have been dismissed from the UN. There were several recordings released. And if I had permission, I would actually ask you to play these recordings on the air. One of them said, do you want us to do a study of rape and gender-based violence? We're not even an agency that does anything like that. We're not trained to do anything like that. What we do is provide services to victims. I'm trying to remember the other agency. I can't right now remember the name of the other agency, but they were referring to another pressure situation in which the UN official representing the U.S. position was saying that he wanted to create a Darfur-like situation because the Darfur situation and all of the press about it eventually led to the indictment of Omar al-Bashir, who was finally taken to the ICC after he was overthrown. So that indicates that those are examples of a massive disinformation campaign. And we say that is a part of the hybrid warfare that the U.S. now engages in. I can't imagine there will be any more wars like Afghanistan or Iraq involving huge U.S. troop commitments. Instead, we'll see hybrid warfare waged by massive disinformation campaigns, censure, sanctions, covert operations, and proxy wars. The candidate for a proxy war, go ahead. Did you ask a question?
Yes, I do have a question. Thank you for explaining
this.
Go ahead.
It's hard for me to just keep talking without a question. Go ahead.
What really inspired the need for this conversation was Libya, in my opinion. And I'll explain this. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, the State Department, the Defense Department, the CIA, and other agencies determined that there was something in Libya that it wanted. Gaddafi was not a threat. The New York Times has done a very glowing story on him. At the time that the NATO planes began the devastation at U.S. request, and Britain and France, et cetera, and joined in, Libya had the largest humanitarian water project in the world. He also was sharing the wealth of the light crude oil with all of its citizens. There was no poverty. There was the highest level of health, education, virtually tiny amount of illiteracy, and everybody was paid, even if they were unemployed, they were being paid what they would normally earn. So you could say of all the countries in Africa, Libya was a model, irrespective of what it was at the beginning. What it evolved into was something that a lot of the other leaders in Africa were wanting to work with Gaddafi to get off the dollar and go into their own currency, the gold denier. Right. And so they didn't have to rely upon the United States' hegemonic principles, economic principles there, and the form of kind of a backwoods colonialism that we've been offering ever since. So they destroyed him. Now you look at Libya today, it's a completely failed country. There are all forms of proof of slave trading, rape, and exploitation. The United States caused all this, and yet no one in this administration responsible has actually apologized. In fact, Hillary Clinton just did nothing but cackle, you know, that we went there and he's dead, and laughed. Well, look at the video of him being sodomized with a knife to see if that's worth laughing at. It's cruel and inhumane. So the average American knows little or nothing about Africa. And so this is important to see that what happened in Libya was not an exclusive one-off tragedy, that it's happening and has for a long time. The assassination of Lumumba and all the other democratically elected people, if they weren't in alignment with our geopolitical and economic needs, in came the jackals. Now, I've spoken with John Perkins. He would go in, he would give them all kinds of unlimited wealth and protection. If they said no, in came the people to assassinate them, and they did. So I just wanted to show that the American people may not be aware of how nefarious one administration is after the other, irrespective of whether they're Democrat or Republican. It's really immaterial. And could you give us any of the background that you're familiar with about Libya? And does Libya in any way represent, in your mind or research, an example of what can go wrong with American policy when it doesn't comport with what the people in a country want for their own democracies?
Oh, exactly. And you don't have to ask for my research. As soon as this started, the Ethiopian people started saying, we're afraid we're going to be the next the next Libya, Syria, or Yugoslavia. In fact, there were essays written in outlets like Politico, in which Yugoslavians who thought that what the U.S. did in Yugoslavia, breaking it into pieces, was just great, describing the situation as very similar. It is somewhat similar in that Ethiopia's challenge is to overcome ethnic strife, to create a sense of citizenship that supersedes ethnic identity. And this is one of the things that the TPLF did, was to aggravate ethnic conflict. There are 11 states in Ethiopia, and the constitution that the TPLF instituted sounds good. It's called ethnic federalism. And the first time I heard about it, it sounded to me like it was protecting unique indigeneity. But the way it works is that a Tigrayan in Amhara doesn't have the rights of an Amhara there. An Amhara in Tigray doesn't have the rights of a Tigrayan. And because there are people who have been living in the other states for many years who are not of the ethnicity that it's assigned, this is a cause of constant strife and violence. And Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is working towards developing a new institution that will give all Ethiopians the same rights within Ethiopia. Now, if Ethiopia stays together, it has much more power to negotiate with the West and the rest of the industrialized world about things like labor protection. It has a large, competent, reportedly competent labor force. Another thing they need to negotiate with the rest of the world is, or with the industrialized world, is, of course, resource extraction. And most resource extraction contracts in Africa are a disgrace. I'll say the country where they're gold mining or oil drilling going to get 5%, and then they don't even get the 5%. And Africa has a kleptocratic class that enables this. I have no reason to think that Abiy Ahmed is a kleptocrat. Whatever his politics may be, and it's not quite clear to me yet what his economic policies may be, aside from what I said about wanting citizenship to supersede ethnicity. But he's not. And if Ethiopia stays together, he can negotiate not only about labor protection, but also about resource extraction. And as an example, neighboring Eritrea has a contract to mine gold with a Canadian corporation, and it's a 60-40 split, which is way, way better than most African countries get. Another thing they can negotiate to protect themselves about are security issues. Ethiopia is very, well, the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia is the heart of the Horn of Africa, the largest population, very geostrategic because it is, well, Eritrea is right on the Red Sea. The Horn is on the Red Sea in the Indian Ocean, and the waterways where all of the oil, well, I'm going to say all because some of it probably goes to the Mediterranean, but I think at least 40% of the world's oil traffic goes through those waterways. So it's very deep.
Why would we be intervening in this particular African country, Ethiopia? I know why we intervened in some of the other countries. I know why we intervened in Egypt and Algeria and South Africa. I'm not in Ivory Coast. I'm not sure why we intervened. What was to be gained by intervening and supporting a corrupt regime against a democratically elected regime in Ethiopia?
Well, the U.S. doesn't like to see independence. Ethiopia was asserting itself, and it had formed an alliance with both Eritrea and Somalia. That could be a powerful alliance asserting their independence in the Horn of Africa. U.S. doesn't like independence, just straight out doesn't like it. Eritrea is the only, well, possibly Zimbabwe. I think Eritrea and Zimbabwe are the only two countries that don't collaborate with AFRICOM demand. And Ethiopia, under the TPLF, provided troops to U.S. missions all over Africa. In fact, the U.S. arranged for Ethiopia to invade Somalia in 2006 and overthrow the Islamic courts, which were not a liberal, like a European classical liberal government, but were popular and were a relief of Somalia because without being extreme, they established order after a long period of instability. The U.S. Got Ethiopia to march in and overthrow the Islamic courts. And after that, you got al-Shabaab. They got al-Shabaab. And there's been a U.S. commanded mission there ever since. Ethiopian troops served in Sudan, South Sudan, North Africa. And as long as that was the case, and as long as they didn't attempt to express any independence from the U.S., the U.S. tolerated all of their human rights abuses. In fact, there was during Obama's presidency, they had an election, and the results reported were 100%, that 100% had voted for the TPLF. And in a press conference, Susan Rice actually laughed about this, which most Ethiopians took as a great insult. Someone in the press pool asked her, well, do you think this is credible? And she laughed and said, oh, 100%. In the same press conference, Obama came out and talked about what a great democratic achievement Ethiopia was. Another reason is, of course, China. China has great economic interests in Ethiopia. And of course, the Horn is closer to China than any other part of Africa. China met with Ethiopia shortly after this started and said they wanted to develop a plan to protect their interests. Chinese investment in Libya was greatly destroyed. So they want to protect their interests, and one of those is the electricity delivery infrastructure of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Have you heard of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam?
Yes.
Okay. This is a very important part of this picture. Ethiopia has the potential to become very prosperous, and the more prosperous it becomes, the more likely it is to assert its independence. The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which is on the border and Sudan, would be the seventh largest in the world. Well, it already is. I think it may be about to start generating electricity, or it may have. It will do that gradually as the dam builds. But it has the potential to provide electricity to all of Ethiopia, and also even to make it possible for Ethiopia to export electricity to its neighbors. If you know anything about Africa, you know that electricity shortages are one of the main things holding it back. So Ethiopia is already, well, before the war, I'm not sure if this is true now, but I would imagine the fastest growing economy in Africa, the second largest population. So the Ethiopian Grand Renaissance Dam has the potential to create a real powerhouse in the region. And as I said, such a prosperous country would be a real challenge to U.S. hegemony. And there are already a lot of complaints about Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia forming this alliance in the kinds of journals, you know, like the Council on Foreign Relations, et cetera, their journal, say that this is a great danger. And of course, that these are all the heads of these three states are all dictators, which is not true. And there's one other thing I'm going to skip back that I didn't say about this, which is that there are two excuses for military presence and the other kinds of pressure that are involved in hybrid warfare. One is the war on terror, and the other is humanitarian emergency. And in Ethiopia, the argument is humanitarian emergency. I don't know how anyone can believe this. I mean, we have over 500,000 homeless people on the streets here. Nobody's doing anything about it. Certainly no one federally. There's some cities trying. We have, you know, a gulag, a prison gulag, the largest prison gulag in the world, which is disproportionately filled with African Americans and Latinx Americans. Plus we've done all this damage all over the world for probably as long as you and I have been alive and earlier, and really throughout the history of the American Empire. But how can anybody believe that the U.S. has humanitarian intentions and is trying to stop genocide? That's one of the main arguments, stop genocide. We have to go in to stop genocide. That's what they said in Libya. That's what they said in Syria. And Rwanda is always cited. This is the greatest crisis since Rwanda, the greatest migration. We have to stop another Rwanda from happening. Well, if you study the history of the Rwandan war and genocide, it was all supported, created by the U.S. Boutros Ghali, who was the UN Secretary General at the time, said repeatedly that the Rwandan genocide was 100% the fault of the Americans. They backed the army that invaded from Uganda and waged a four-year war, which ended in the massacres of the last 100 days. And it's been proven since, particularly by a book by Judy Weaver, Crimes of the In Praise of Blood, Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, that there was just as large a genocide against the Hutu population. The standard story is that it was just Hutus killing Tutsis. What's that? Oh, somebody's trying to call me. I'm going to ignore it. But Rwanda is cited constantly. As soon as you start to hear that there's another Rwanda coming and that we have to stop this Rwanda. This time it's our responsibility because we had it, we allowed it in 1994, then you know that country is in trouble. That country is the target of a U.S. Regime change, so-called regime change policy. I keep wanting to come up with a better term than regime change because it seems to imply that every government the U.S. tries to overthrow is a regime, and that's not the case. But when Rwanda is cited and you hear, this is Rwanda again, we have to stop it, we failed then, this is genocide, the U.S. is trying to overthrow another government.
Let me just interject here, please.
The war on terror is sort of fading as the humanitarian intervention excuse rises. But recently, the war on terror was used as the excuse for introducing U.S. troops in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And this is ridiculous because Congo is 95% Christian. That doesn't even mean that it's 5% Muslim. So the idea that ISIS, they say ISIS is in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, that's farcical. So this is the humanitarian intervention argument being used in Ethiopia, and all its most famous advocates are speaking up, particularly Samantha Power. She wrote this book, America in the Age of Genocide, which is an argument for America's responsibility to intervene all over the world to stop genocide.
I would like to interject now, and thank you for that insight. Just a few points. Hillary and Bill Clinton were close friends with Kagame, the person who was leading that genocide in Rwanda.
Yes.
And he has been praised since then, and no effort has been made to show his guilt. Now, as far as complicity in the actual genocide, I believe it was in Mother Jones or Rolling Stone, there was an article where the reporter had a lot of exclusive interviews with people in France, in the United Nations, and showed that there were multiple opportunities to stop the genocide. In fact, mm-hmm. the general who was heading the UN forces in Rwanda had made a cable to the very person who headed the UN and also went to his Canadian overseers. And he said that he knew where the weapons that were going to be used. I believe the French had supplied those weapons. He knew where they were, that he could go and confiscate them. And he was told to stand down. Then the Belgians were also there and the Italians protecting, but then the Belgians were kidnapped. Ten of them were kidnapped, kept in this place. And he said he had a way of getting in, rescuing those Belgians, and he was told to stand down. After they were killed, then the Belgian government decided to remove them. Then they were bringing women outside of the UN mission and making a circle around them of men, whacking these women with the machetes so that it would take all day for them to bleed and die. And he had his armed men there. And again, he could have shot them and stopped that, rescued the women. He was told, stand down. So every effort that was made, he was told to stand down. And probably the worst of it, as if that wasn't bad enough, was that there was a church. And there were, I believe, a little over 2,000 people crowded into this Catholic church, and men, women, and children, Rwandans, mainly those who were not involved in the conflict but would have been victims of the conflict. And the soldiers guarding them were leaving, so he said his soldiers would take their place, because around the church were all of the Tutsis smacking their pants with machetes. And he was told to stand down. As a result, almost all the people in that church were slaughtered that day, men, women, and children. Now, this was all documented. None of this was reported in the American media. None of this was discussed by those who support our foreign policy. All of this was covered up. Are you aware of that part of this story concerning Rwanda?
Yeah, there's some elements of what you said there is true, and some elements which are part of the received U.S.-backed story. What is true is that the U.N. Security Council considered sending a peacekeeping mission in, actually enlarging the peacekeeping mission that was there, and the U.S. sent Madeleine Albright to make sure that didn't happen. She was the UN ambassador at the time. And not only was there no peacekeeping mission sent in or enlarged, the peacekeepers who were there were withdrawn. When it was all over, the US went in and built a military base in Rwanda, saying they were doing so for relief purposes, even though they had stopped any kind of intervention when it was going on, when the last 100 days, actually this was the last 100 days of a four-year civil war, were going on. Now they're going to establish a military base to help with relief efforts. The story about the church, that is in Philip Gurevich's book, Leave No One to Tell the Story. Allison, her name, the UN investigator, that's her book. Gurevich's book is We Regret to Inform You That that in the morning all of your family will be killed. That's not precise, but that's basically the title. And that book has become a curriculum in college and even high school classes. And that is a story which tells this simple Manichean tale about evil, savage Hutus, innocent angelic Tutsis, and likening it to the Holocaust. Rwanda is constant, the Rwandan government and its supporters are constantly, most of all Israel, are constantly likening it to the Holocaust. And when the U.S. wants to start a war, it will hold some sort of event and invite the president of Rwanda and someone like Netanyahu or Elie Wiesel, when he was still alive, to speak and say that these are similar situations, and now the same situation is coming up, for example, in Syria. So the Gurevich book is not one that I would recommend or one that I think is accurate. I'm sure that this did happen in the church. I don't have any doubt of that. There were massacres everywhere. And according to Judy Weaver's book, millions of Hutu people were massacred by Kagame's army, which was the invading army. Bill Clinton did turn away quite intentionally. And years later, he showed up in Rwanda to shed crocodile tears and say, "I'm so sorry." When the fact was that he sent Madeleine Albright to make sure that the UN did not intervene.
And let
after
me just,
that, since then, oh my God, here's another Rwanda, has been a centerpiece of U.S. humanitarian interventionist policy.
Let me answer something in this additionally, and thank you for that explanation. Mm-hmm. I believe I misstated. I meant the Hutu were against the Tutsis in that particular episode. I did not read that in any book. My reference was direct. I watched the documentary where this was actually, everything I just mentioned was actually filmed. So it's not hearsay. It's accurate information. I didn't use anyone's book because a book could be a person's bias or misunderstanding. But when you're actually seeing the women in a circle and you're seeing the dead bodies at the end of the day, and you're seeing the UN soldiers, the peacekeeping mission, doing nothing, and and the general was giving the commentary on that. So those are actual instances. Now, here's what's important. The same Madeleine Albright that was sent in to kill us stopping this, and we could have stopped it. In fact, an interview with several of the people in the White House at the time this was going on said the Clintons couldn't be bothered. I think at one point he was watching a ball game or some sporting events, and he just didn't want to make this important. He didn't, everything you could do to do somersaults around not saying that this was genocide, they did, because if it was genocide, they would have had to intervene. Well, it was genocide. And that shows you the corruption of our State Department, the UN, and the White House at that time. It also shows you the corruption of the mainstream media for not putting pressure on the true story to come out. Additionally, that's the same Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State, when asked by Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes, and I have the clip, where 500,000 Iraqi children died because of the Clinton sanctions. So then I got the sanctions, and it is a war crime to bomb or destroy civilian infrastructure necessary for their life. And they intentionally had the Defense Department bomb water treatment plants, electrical grids, food storage areas. And as a result, children began to die of parasitic infections and diseases that should have been prevented but weren't. The idea was, as it would later turn out, they believed, Bill Clinton and all of his cabinet and people in the military, that if enough children died and enough of the citizens were helpless seeing their children die, they would revolt against Gaddafi and there'd be a popular uprising and he'd be thrown out of power. That didn't work. So when Leslie Albright said, Leslie said,
which country are we talking about now?
We're talking about Iraq. Is it acceptable to have 500,000 dead children? She said, yes. So why should we be surprised by anything that Madeleine Albright, with her neocon philosophy and a close supporter, both the Secretary of State and UN representative for the United States, with the power that she had, and then the media just praised her to high heavens. Oh, she was the new example of a woman breaking the ceiling. No, she, in my personal opinion, should be challenged on all of the policies she instigated, even back in Yugoslavia. One of the many problems with Yugoslavia and Clinton, it balkanized. Well, aren't we balkanizing Central America, South America? Aren't we balkanizing much of Africa? Isn't there an effort to balkanize?
Yeah, the goal balkanization is to be in Ethiopia, Libya? To balkanize Ethiopia. Go ahead. I'm sorry, interrupting.
So
you. Go ahead.
I'm looking at this from a little different perspective. I'm seeing the constant pressure by people in power to accept without challenge the neocon philosophy of the current hegemonic programs. And no one in the media, including much of the liberal media, is willing to push back and say, we shouldn't be doing this. Now, right now, you're under attack. You're under attack for appearing on this program today. There'll be all kinds of people saying, no, she's wrong. We have all these other experts who are in Ethiopia who say it's just the opposite, that this man should never won the Nobel Peace Prize, who's running the country. The people really didn't want him. And your whole story is a fabrication. You do realize they're going to attack you for the statements you're making.
Yeah, it has not been as bad as it was with Rwanda. When I started reporting on Rwanda in 2010, when Victoire and Gabriel Mahosa and two other never mind, I'm ignoring that, were trying to run for president. And this really exposed what the Kagame government was all about. They were all in prison or in exile by the time it was over. And journalists had been shot. An ICTR lawyer had been killed in Tanzania. One of Kagame's former generals had survived an attempted assassination in South Africa. And at that time, when I was one of the only ones, I mean, it was the only one I know of who was calling to talk to the opposition and trying to reason through what was going on and looking at who Paul Kagame is. I mean, if you listen to Paul Kagame speak, you realize that he's insane. He's a sociopath. It's not difficult to see. So I was one of the only ones doing that, and I was constantly attacked by Rwandans. It hasn't been that bad with Ethiopia. I mean, I'm sure I'm being attacked in circles that I don't know about, and I'm attacked once in a while on Twitter, but the attacks are so silly that one yesterday made my day. It was something like, you should be banned from all social media. You're a genocide supporter, and you're against U.S. capitalism and globalization. Well, okay.
Have you thought about asking Amy Goodman to come on Democracy Now! To debate the issue with her or her experts, so the public can have an opportunity to hear both sides and decide for themselves what they want to accept or reject?
I've written a number of letters to Democracy Now! About this, in which I cited things that I've written, things that other people have written. And in the last one, I asked them to contact a photographer and human rights investigator who is on the ground in Amhara region, Jamal Countess. And I spoke to him once about atrocities happening in Amhara. The TPLF have invaded Amhara and Afar. Those are two neighboring states, and created a huge number of refugees. This doesn't get the press that all these allegations of Tigray genocide do. There are many Amhara who are calling it genocide as well. I'm a little uneasy these days with the word genocide because it's so overused, but that's another story. I spoke to him, and I put the audio and the interview on Pacifica, and published them. So I sent those to Democracy Now. No response. And I've written three of these letters to Democracy Now with no response. For some reason, they have relied primarily on Nima El-Bahir, who is a CNN correspondent. She's Sudanese. And Amy keeps having her on and introducing her as the award-winning journalist, Nima El-Bahir. And I'm sure she has won some awards. But CNN has been producing the most one-sided, obviously one-sided version of events here. It's always the Ethiopian government and the Ethiopian army. Tigrayans are victims. Tigrayans are suffering genocide. The government wants to exterminate anything Tigrayan. I don't know why Democracy Now! Is using her as their sole source. But Democracy Now! Has, for a long time, supported the humanitarian interventionist argument. They did so in Libya. They did so in Syria. As I remember, Libya was the first time. I don't know how they reported. Well, were they even? I don't know about Yugoslavia. I'm not sure if Democracy Now.
Well, I think it would be interesting.
It certainly wasn't as widespread as it is now.
And I think it would be an interesting discussion for you to invite the reporter from CNN on, so that you can have an open dialogue and let the public see the resources you're both using, the evidence you have, the evidence she has. That would be an interesting program. But until that time, you can expect the mainstream media to be one-sided. And I looked at all the media. All of it is one-sided, and it's all pro-administration, not looking at any of the same policymakers who have been responsible for Libya and the false allegations against Assad in Syria, in spite of what Seymour Hersh and Beasley and some outstanding reporters who are truly independent have found that virtually all the things we were told about Libya have been lies, and all the things we were told about Syria have been lies. But then again, everything we were told about Honduras was lies, and the Ukraine were lies, and even Venezuela have been lies. So at least here we have a forum for a voice for the voiceless on this issue. My final question, I need a short answer. When you look at the new prime minister who was given the Nobel Peace Prize, what were the circumstances behind his popular appeal and his rising to become prime minister?
In 2018, as I said, there were mass uprisings that overturned the TPLF government of 27 years. That's how Prime Minister Abiy became prime minister. And he was prime minister for 3 years before there was an election. Which he won in a landslide. It's possible to criticize the election, but even the side vilifying the government have not made much effort to discount that election. I mean, the U.S. before it even happened, that they knew it was going to be a specious election, but they haven't pushed that too much since then.
And thank you for being on today. We really appreciate you coming here and sharing this story. Ann Garrison from San Francisco, talking about a very controversial issue with different points of view, but the point of view she is staying as someone who's been on the ground communicating over a period of years, also doing award-winning reporting, has not been part of the dialogue, and we just believe it should be. We'd love to have debates on this, but unless someone's willing to debate her, then we're only hearing their side, the mainstream media, but we had a chance today to hear her side here.